So, once again, I'm Deborah Newman-Kamen, and was asked to be the moderator of this session, not because I have any expertise whatsoever in ideas that work for adult education. So I'm actually here to learn from our panel, as you are. And we're hoping to really just make this a somewhat informal conversation and hope, as always, that we can come home from convention with some ideas that we can try to see if they work at home. So I want to first say that Rabbi Gil Steinlauf was supposed to be on the panel. Unfortunately, his mother is quite ill, and he had to go be with her, so he was not able to join us for the convention. And, of course, our thoughts and prayers go out to him and his family. I'm going to actually let each of our panelists introduce themselves, and you should have a very short bio about everyone, so not to take time from the session to do that, and there'll be time for each person to present, and then, of course, questions and answers.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. Is this on? Yeah? So my name is Menachem Krediter. I'm the rabbi of Congregation Netivot Shalom in Berkeley, California. And part of what excites me about the question is hopefully in our openness to the definition of what education actually means. If education is about text, then we could also be a little bit Derrida about what text means. Text isn't only the codes or the books or the information that we're handed, but also the artifacts, which are people and the environment that we're in. So number one is I'd like to define education broadly when I respond about some of the things that I do and some of the things that in my community we experience as education. Much of that is undefinable, because when you look someone in the eyes, that's when you learn. And so first and foremost, I would say that the way to create vibrant educational environments is look people in the eyes and try to remember their names and something about them, because you actually care. So it's good to be a master of information. I think that much of our education trains us to know stuff. But hopefully what we learn along the way is that knowing each other is better than stuff. And so in as much as that isn't such a chiddush, I'd just like to emphasize it. Looking people in the eyes would be quite lovely to create vibrant learning environments. My own path, in terms of what I consider to be the education that I do with the adults in our community, is actually not limited in any way to the adults in my community. So I'll just use an example. We have a class for those exploring a Jewish identity, which I think is a fairly common thing in shuls. I actually hesitate from doing it because one-on-one conversations are much better when it comes to being with people on their journeys, but thank God we have too many people to keep track, for me to keep track of, at least by my own organizational standards. And so I thought a class would be a good experience. And what we did is we had general modules. We all have the same similar kind of definitions, I'm sure. And then every fifth class was an Ask the Rabbi class. And so it happened that at the second series where we were doing an Ask the Rabbi class, one of the participants emails me and says, I can't come. Would you mind recording it? So I use a function online called SoundCloud. I don't know if anybody has an account there. It's a wonderful service online. It's not free. It's actually a little bit expensive. But if you use it, you find that it's beneficial. You can track how many people listen to whatever track you might have made, be it musical, be it informational. So he said, would you mind recording it? And I said, oh, that'd be great. So I recorded it. I put it on SoundCloud. And it occurs to me just to share it with anybody. So what I did is I called it Ask the Rabbi, and we're talking about circumcision, which in the Bay Area is quite the conversation to have. And we're talking about Zionism and hunting and all the things that people were bringing, because that's what we're talking about. I couldn't have prepared for the conversation, so part of what the educative moment was is conversation. It's based on a lifetime of preparation, which I think we all do. When I put it online, Daron Raske, who I don't know if you guys know Daron, but Stephanie's wife is our colleague, Daron runs a network called the JCast Network, and he said, oh, I see that you have this thing on SoundCloud. Would you like a podcast? I said, what do I have to do? He says, nothing. So I say, great. So part of the educative process is just putting a lot of stuff out there in the natural way that we have conversations that we think might be helpful. Part of my concern when I started doing that on YouTube or on Facebook or on Twitter or all the other platforms is, really, is this going to matter? I have no idea. Is someone going to think that I'm self-promoting? Is it about me for them? And the truth is, when you leave all that fear behind and you're actually not talking about yourself, you're teaching Torah, it's incredible the kind of resonance. So on the one hand, we have an educational program within our shul. We really do. We've got learning. We've got Wednesday afternoon Parsha. We've got a conversion class. We have a Talmud class. We have Sunday morning series. But that's nothing unique. I mean, we all do that sort of thing. The question is, do we see the stuff that we're presenting, that we're producing, as worthy of really amplifying out there? So one of the ways in which we do that, which I do that, is using SoundCloud and all the other digital social media stuff that's out there. And I think the facility with those techniques is incredibly, incredibly important for us to master. It takes a lot of bravery, and it's not generational. It might be that our thumbs might be more attuned to smartphones if we got them when we were younger, but it's also clear that once you start playing with them, they can be, well, at least in my case, quite addictive. And they also might be incredibly fulfilling, because if you have a moment in your community, shul or not, where you really think you put your heart into something, and you don't get a response, but the method with which you created it and shared it is somehow out there, the sipuk nefesh, the incredible internal reward from getting one like or a positive comment, shouldn't be minimized. We can laugh at it. It's kind of silly, but I have just as vulnerable a soul as anybody's. And there are moments where within my local community, I'm not getting the kind of personal satisfaction or professional satisfaction for doing the stuff I care about. But if it's out there and someone says it's worthy and it matters, it's amazing. So one of the things I would encourage you to do not only is to share on social media, but to put nuggets of your own process as an educative experience for yourself and for others, let's say on a blog, because then you'll find that people in Japan are reading your Torah. It's shocking. So, one more thing beyond that is that if you have methods of putting your words out there, it is easier than anyone thinks to actually create books of your stuff. And no one's reading books except everyone's reading books. They're just calling it different things. And I will say again that I want my community to be totally seduced by Torah. The best way to accomplish that is to be visibly seduced by Torah myself. And so I would just encourage us not to think about creating vibrant learning environments for others. I want to be in a shul that learns. I want to be in a community that creates Torah that isn't all mine. And so one of the things that we've tried to do as a shul is encourage not just our members to give Divrei Torah, which they do every Shabbos, but we collected them and turned them into a book. It's available online. It's available in bookstores. It's called Paths of Torah. And it's not hard to do if you're a learning environment. And then it's just this beautiful loop of Jewish pride. Not based on scholarship, though we have many scholars in my shul. That's true. It's based on people feeling empowered to actually have a Torah voice. And so part of what I have to be ready as a rabbi, I have to be ready for people who know a whole lot more than me about everything I care about, to be in the room when I'm trying to teach. And I'll give just this one vignette. So in my community, I had to get used to Robert Alter being a member of my shul. It's intense. And I remember once in Simchas Torah, thank God my guard was down, and I was sitting with him, and he's a Saba in our preschool. I mean, that's who he is. Those of you who know him personally, you know he's not Robert, he's Uri. He's a sweet, sweet person. And I said to him, you know, Uri, how terrified I was when I walked into shul to talk Torah in front of you. And then I realized, after getting to know you, you come for community. He says, of course I come for community. He reads Haftorah. He doesn't teach Bible. He reads Haftorah in his shul. And that's why even the people who I look at as the most potent vessels of Torah in the world need us. Because we help convene that community and not preclude the possibility that they and their equals, who they see as equals next to them, have a voice. So I would say, if I wanted to sum up everything I was saying in one sentence, it would be this. That's a few sentences. You have incredible Torah inside of you. And there is every opportunity to put it out there in a passionate, forceful, loving, and seductive way. And people are so hungry and thirsty for us to model the openness with Torah and the shareability of Torah and the open source mentality that allows Torah to really, really thrive. And it's not based on where we are, because geography doesn't exist anymore. The platforms for sharing our Torah are there and ready for us to use.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Annie Tucker, and for 7 years I was the associate rabbi of the Jewish Center in Princeton, New Jersey. I'm just now finishing up my first year as the rabbi of Beth Hillel Congregation B'nai Emunah in Wilmette, Illinois. And it's wonderful to be here, and I actually hope that we'll be able to use a large part of this session to talk amongst ourselves about ideas related to adult Jewish learning. I think there's so much wisdom in this room, not only, and really maybe not even especially on this panel. So I hope that we'll really have a chance to talk to one another a little bit. When I thought about this question of creating vibrant limud and communities of adult Jewish learning, the piece that was most interesting to me in that was less about programs at work and hot new models and ideas for innovative programming. And it was more about how we take whatever we're doing and use it as an opportunity to create relationship, create relationship between us and our congregants, help our congregants create relationships amongst themselves, and of course, create a relationship between the individual and the text, right? Relational Judaism, which is very zeitgeisty right now. And I wanted to talk about that in three different ways. So the first I would call creating micro-communities, or also I might talk about it in terms of niche programming or niche marketing. An example that I would give of this from my work in the Princeton community is that one of the advantages I had as being a second rabbi in a community is that I was able to offer women's trips. My first women's trip was to Israel, my second one was to Jewish Spain, and my third was to Eastern Europe. I was able to do this because my senior colleague offered congregational trips. But the idea of doing a trip for women, and that's only a particular example of any kind of niche market or micro community you might think about, there are a lot of advantages to it. There are a lot of advantages in terms of promoting and marketing. It sort of gives you a very specific target audience to go after. There are a number of advantages in terms of creating the program. My women's trip to Israel looked different from a normal congregational trip to Israel in a number of different ways, which I'm happy to talk about in a little more at length. But I also think perhaps the greatest advantage was that it creates a really special, intense community. I think that trips in general do that, even mixed gender trips. But going as a group of Jewish women, there was a sense of connection and bonding that happened almost immediately, so much so that really upon returning from the first trip, there was a desire to do another trip right away. I can talk about that too. I think it was a mistake to do one so in close proximity. But so niche marketing, thinking about what are those sub-communities within our community that we might want to target, and then thinking about what are those things that would be most meaningful to those sub-communities and intentionally going after those individuals in that way. So that's sort of the first thing I would think about. The second thing I would think about in terms of adult Jewish learning is sort of intentionally creating community in our classes and in our spaces of limud. And the example I would give for this is that both in Princeton and also in Wilmette, I teach a Parsha class on Shabbat morning. It's called Bible Baboker. I imagine many of our shuls have Shabbat morning Parsha classes. But I think that what to me makes Bible Baboker a little bit special and what I want to talk about just for a moment is how you take a group of people who come to study Torah together every Shabbat, many Shabbats, and really create a community of learners. So when I was in Princeton, some of the things that I did to transform that group of people into a real community, which it very much did become, there were a couple different things. One is that I made sure that every year as we got to Simchat Torah, we really had a siyum. As we hit, the end of Devarim and then prepared to start Bereishit again, we came together, not on Shabbat morning, but on an evening in my home, to sort of ritualize the moment. And also I invited members of the group to share reflections on their year of learning. And I actually think that in that sharing and reflection, a really beautiful spirit of community began to form. We also started to have events outside of Bible Baboker, sort of for the Bible Baboker community, a few Shabbat dinners, different things like that. And again, it sort of took this group of people that mostly knew each other originally by sitting and studying a text together and sort of broadened it out. And one of the things that I feel proudest about in terms of Bible Baboker, in addition to the learning, is that it was a group of people who really didn't know each other well at the beginning that came to know and to love each other quite a bit. And when I would go to Shiva Minyanim, for members of the Bible Baboker community, I was always struck by how many other members of the community were there. Something sort of magical had happened, and I think it takes a little bit of intentionality on our part to build in spaces and opportunities for people to connect, not only around text, but also in other ways. So that would be sort of my second example is intentionality in creating community. Now the third thing I would throw out in terms of creating vibrant communities of limud is taking advantage of the unique talents and skill sets of our members. And the example that I would give for this is that both in Princeton and also in Wilmette, I did a series on end-of-life and afterlife issues, both the theology and sort of the halakha. But I started each of those series with a panel that was populated by members of the community who had particular expertise. So medical doctors specializing in end-of-life, social workers or hospice workers specializing in end-of-life. In my community in Wilmette, the local Jewish funeral director obviously has a lot of expertise around end-of-life issues. And in my mind, this is a little bit different from something which is also good and important, which is getting back to sort of niche marketing or micro communities, running programs for lawyers about Jewish law, right? That is one good and excellent way of structuring an adult Limud program. But I think that what's a little bit different here is that it's taking people and allowing them to use their secular expertise in a Jewish context and making them feel sort of like the experts in a place of Jewish learning. And I think that that's an empowering experience for them. And it also very practically sort of drives participation, because lots of congregants would come out to see their fellow congregant presenting on this panel, and there was something really nice about that. And so to see sort of a local cancer doctor really being part of this Jewish space talking about Jewish issues, I think that there's something that individual got out of participating in that way. And I think it also sends a message that even if our expertise are more secularly oriented than Jewish oriented, that each of us has something to bring to the Jewish conversation. So that I think I'm going to stop there for now. As I said, I hope we'll have opportunities to discuss further.
Hi everyone, I'm Elliot Cosgrove at the Park Avenue Synagogue. It's always good to acknowledge your teachers before you begin. So earlier, Rabbi Carol Levithan, the newest member of the RA team, was here, and it was my internship with her when I was a rabbinical student and she was at the JCC. I had the Lilmod thing from JTS, but the art and gift and the magic of teaching adult education, the Lelamet piece, came from Rabbi Levithan. And so if I'm doing anything good in adult learning, then it's a credit to her as much as anyone else. If I would frame it in a certain way, and with my colleagues, it would be, it actually builds on what both of you said. The Midrash, it's in Sigda d'Rav Kahana, with Matan Torah coming up, of the Anochi Hashem Elokecha. The idea that with the manna came down, Torah comes down, and you're meeting, it tasted according to every person's taste. And so as I've thought about constructing an adult education program for a 1,500 family community, it is simply offering a class from 7 to 9 on a Tuesday evening and expecting that to just magically happen, I don't think that's a system that recommends itself to the future. I think you have to think creatively, thinking in terms of your markets, creating new markets, aggressively going after those who are learners and those who don't know that they could be learners but will be. Reflect on the last few years as I've tried my best to create a virtuous cycle. I think Menachem used the language of a loop, a feedback loop, of the idea that there's such an abundance of activity going on between the Friday night dinners, between the evening classes, the lunch and learns, the Torahs on tap, the otherwise, that there is just this cycle of learning that goes on, that the things. So it was just 2 weeks, or last week we had Yehuda Mirsky in our building who's trying to sell his new book out on Rav Kook. So I gave a sermon on Rav Kook because it was Yom HaAtzmaut. And then it just one thing led to another. So everything was happening in a certain context in which, to the best as I can, I'm trying to create a community where the conversations are somewhat coherent and cogent. Not everything fits neatly, but I'm trying to create a theme. So this year, we talked a lot about Kaplan, because 1934 was the year Judaism as a Civilization was published. So my adult learning class was on Kaplan. We invited Mel Skult to teach on Kaplan when we had, a few years ago it was Mordechai Waxman 50 years since tradition and change. Now, it's just like writing a sermon. It's not that my I invented that. Not I didn't invent those books or those people, but the concept that how could a Jewish learning year be about anything other than that? Of course we're going to talk about Kaplan on the occasion of the 80th, right? So it became news. It's a branding thing. It's a saying, this is a theme of the year. So just so everyone knows where we're heading, and my colleague Rabbi Savinor is going to be leading the charge on this next year. Next year we're looking at 1945 and, 70 years. Since the liberation of the camps, and hopefully ending with a Eastern Europe trip and a lot on memory. So that's anywhere from Yerushalmi and his students and talking about. So it's not a year on the Holocaust, but it's a year on what is the role of memory in the shaping of Jewish identity. Maybe some things on past, present, future of anti-Semitism. Things like that. Those are the topics, and that's going to be the focal point of the year. And so you create your theme, and then you create your markets within that theme. So let me just touch on a few things. Number one, Andy, I agree with you on the niche markets. So we have a Women's in the Bible class sponsored by our Women's Network. We have a Torah on Tap that our colleague Steve Reen gets great attendance to through the Men's Club, where they're literally meeting at a bar and they're studying Torah, and a bunch of guys are having a great time doing it. We had an adult learning retreat. A lot of empty nesters, who we had 92 people, go out to Princeton, to the conference center in Princeton, and we drove out, and the registration fees paid for itself, and it was a great community builder on a non-bar bat mitzvah Shabbat. We had, just in terms of the culture of expectation, it's my expectation that if you're an educator on staff, you're teaching adult learning. I think it sends a very important message. If you're the congregational school principal, if you are the young family director, you teach. It creates a culture, a set of expectation. I think the next thing are partnerships or communal cooperation. Realizing it's very important because you realize what you're good at and you realize what other people are better at than you. And so, whether it's Rabbi Zuckerman teaching the Hartman I Engage materials, whether it's, I want to talk a bit more at length about Melton, the Walking With series through AJU, creating these relationships with curriculum that has been designed by people who aren't worrying about every Shiva baby naming and bar mitzvah that I'm thinking about. These are incredible resources. Now it's tricky because if you let AIPAC into your building, then they obviously want to make you an outpost for AIPAC. You have to the driving force always has to be what you're seeking to accomplish in your community. But if you can leverage. And I want to be careful what I say because I see some colleagues here who represent these organizations. But if you can, if you're lucky enough, to have Ben Summer living in the tri-state area, and he's coming in to represent the Torah of JTS, but he's also coming in because he is a superb scholar of Hebrew Bible, then it's a win-win as far as your community is concerned, as long as you, with the JTS, Hartman, JNF, you name it, organization understands the ground rules coming in. I'm a big believer that everyone wins in that situation. The institution, my synagogue, and most importantly, the learners themselves. We've done some really neat things with partnering with other organizations, other synagogues. With Scott Bolton, our colleague, he's really been the driving force. But we've created an Eastside Torah Learning Coalition that we're having a rotation where a conservative rabbi is teaching an Orthodox synagogue and a Reform rabbi in a conservative synagogue, different prakim of Pirkei Avot during this time. right? Now, that unto itself is not actually, it's not creating a volume of learners, but it is sending a very important message that we're all studying the same text, considering all of us as teachers of Torah. It's an incredible moment of PR and goodwill in the community. Melton, we have five classes of Melton going on, a morning and evening class, about 140 people right now enrolled in some expression of Melton. I would say, and I'm not being paid for this, I think Melton is the foundation of building an adult ed empire. It creates a literacy and an expectation that people are learning once a week, creating community. It is an amazing tool. How many people have Melton just raised in your communities? If you have it, if you teach it in the hand, you know, you're creating the relationships with your congregants, but the curriculum is already set. You're going to do with it what you want to do with it. But it's going to, you know, you're gonna be writing a eulogy all night the night before. You have your 9:15 Melton class, and you're going to come in, and it's there, and it's good stuff, and people respond to quality, and it's quality. And so we have, every year, we have a morning class, which is drop-off moms and retirees, and then the evening class, and we have all the graduate classes which are taking place there as well. The other thing is, and Annie, again, this builds on you, is creating these niche markets. So we have classes after Minyan at 8 a.m. We have classes at 9:15 after people drop off at early childhood. We have lunch and learns, which are in Midtown offices. So there are three rabbis. So one of us teaches an adult ed on in the fall. One teaches a lunch and learn. So we have a whole Torah Nuda rotation that goes on. We have the evening classes that are taking place. When we started offering a class, our Hebrew school is 4 to 6. And so we realized that a lot of parents are in the hallways from sort of that 5:15 to 6 hour. So we offer a class then, because those parents aren't going to show up for a 7 p.m. class. We have something in the summers when a lot of our homes clear out, but the dads are still around. We have a men of a certain age class. We had a Skype class with our colleague Rabbi Gratz, which is really easy. And I mean, I remember when this got going when I was in Chicago. Complicated and technology. You really just need a screen and a Skype account. And so Rabbi Gratz teaches, Michael teaches a class from his home in Israel. And it's great. It's amazing. Why wouldn't we all create a relationship with the Masorti community in Israel and have them teach Sunday morning at 10 a.m. after Minyan to whoever wanted to study, right? It's actually not that hard to do. You just have to have someone who's willing on the other end of the phone to teach, if it's a scholar from Israel. So Skype classes are happening, and we're hoping to build on that more next year. Not just the time of day, but we've also played with the frequency. Some classes are once a week, some classes are every other week, some classes are once a month. Those, you know, different strokes for different folks. The final thing I'll say is travel. If you can do it, if your community can do it, travel's a game changer. So we had 40 women go to Israel in February. We have B'nai Mitzvah trips or young family trips or adult learning trips at the conclusion of a two-year Melton cycle. And these just, this cycle continues over and over again. And they bought into the community, they bought into Torah, and you've created an expectation that this is what's going to happen. So I think I'll stop with some of that, and maybe we'll see you then.
Yeah, I'm just curious to know, because you've got a lot going on. And some of us don't have such as large congregations. I'm kind of wondering about budget for adult education. What kind of budgets do your congregations have? And for those of us that don't have big budgets, how do you manage that?
Well, I'll start. We don't have, to be honest, that much of a programming budget. We just, as a shul, went through a pretty aggressive attempt, thank God, successful, to refinance our mortgage, so we weren't really, there was no largesse coming anywhere. So part of what we do is we say, well, every program needs to be either break-even or you need to do some solicitation on the ground. So I would say you can do a lot with a little, depending on who your community is. So with a willing community, well, maybe you've got specialists who can do the teaching. Maybe on staff you can allocate your time and use whatever income comes in for that class to support other classes happening because you can absorb it. So for us, there isn't much of a budget for it. We just have to be scrapping. And it's been a great challenge, which pays great dividends because we feel the urgency of it.
Yeah, I would say something similar. Neither my previous or my current congregation were there enormously robust budgets for adult education. To the extent that there were dedicated funds, they were largely for one or two major scholar-in-resident events a year. There was definitely dedicated money for those things. But in terms of sort of the run-of-the-mill programming, not such a robust budget. What I would add to what Menachem said is, and in both Princeton and in Wilmette, it was more easy to do this. It depends where you're located geographically. But in both my communities, I've been located near major universities, and it's often possible to get scholars from local universities to teach at the synagogue for a much more modest stipend. If they're not traveling, especially if they have connections to faculty members that are congregants of yours, so that's definitely a strategy I've used in both my communities. The other thing that we're talking about a little bit in Wilmette, and I'm curious what other people have to say about this, is the issue of charging for adult education versus not charging. Then on the one hand, I think that we feel often that we're nickeling and diming our congregants a lot, and that adult education should perhaps be one of those things that is included in the cost of dues, especially when it's our own clergy teaching, but perhaps even if it's outside faculty teaching. And then on the other hand, there's what Menachem says, that when you're offering things of quality, you need a budget to support that. And is it a terrible thing to ask people to pay a modest amount towards classes? So that's one of the things that we're thinking about.
I think it's a really important thing to charge people for adult learning. I think it forces people to show up. And I think it, I am on the Upper East Side. So, I recognize that the economics might be a little different, but I just think you're creating value for it. I think it does get tricky when you're talking about, is it a clergy class? But actually, both in Chicago and here, in some ways, also the classes that were driven by the clergy, right, Charlie? I mean, those in some ways supported other opportunities as well. But we do, just in the spirit of transparency, so I do identify a funder. So some of our big name sort of events, I've, through working with my board and leadership, said this is important, and I know we need to fix the air conditioning, I know we need to do this, but we need to tap someone to underwrite a few lectures, a few scholars in residence. And so that does happen. But we also try to operate on a break-even. Whether it's Melton, whether it's adult learning, whether it's our Shabbat dinners, we have a algorithm of how many people will need to show up to invite X person in, and this is the cost of the chicken, this is the cost of the speaker in their hotel room, and this is how we're going to break even on it. So that's,
Yeah, I'm just debating about whether I should build a bonfire up here. It is, it's really cold up here. I don't know if everybody else is cold, but
I got the key open.
Thank you, appreciate that. All right, we're just going to open it up. So,
if I could just follow up on what Elliot said, just speaking from my perspective, there's a lot of different pieces to this, and I'm not saying that this is the end of the discussion, but just to support what Elliot said, just from my own experience, I must say that on occasion I'll do a freebie for a community. And I have noticed, by and large, when I do a freebie, very few people from the synagogue will show up, or even from the rabbinic group will show up. When I'm paid well, people show up. When people invest in something, and when a community invests, it does tend to create a better program. I mean, I'm sometimes real happy and honored to do freebies, and then disappointed that almost nobody shows up.
Should use the microphone.
All right, so why don't you step up and use the microphone, and I know that's a little formal, but that way everybody can hear each other. And also, you can ask questions, but also if you have a program that's working really well for you, everybody would like to hear about it.
Can you also give us your name and where you're from so we can
Me?
Yeah, anybody who speaks.
My name is Ari Lucas. I'm from Los Angeles, California. And maybe on the question of sort of measuring success, you know, often I feel like turnout is the number of people enrolled in a program is the number one measure of success. You know, 90 people showed up, it was a great success. But I've found that, you know, often I'll have 10 people in a room and the power of the connection that comes out of that, but it's hard to measure. So I'm wondering, you know, two questions. One is, what is success or what is the goal of adult learning in a congregational setting? And number two, how do you measure it? That's it.
Look, Ari, I think you have to... It depends on the context. If I have a support group for recovering alcoholics and there are four people in the room, that's a huge success, right? And if I've just invited Ben Sommer in and I'm paying him a lot of money and there are four people in the room, then I'm pissy, right? It depends on... Right, but it's not a one-size-fit-all. So my advice to you, and I've known you since you were little, is, right, your senior rabbi and the president of your shul and your board, make sure you're all in lockstep on what those measures of success are. So if you really have something that you're, you know, meshugal adavar, and you know that success is going to be six people, then just be transparent and clear about it. Say, look, this is really important. We can't call ourselves a shul without having a support group for X, or to have a parsha class, you know, on Shabbos morning. And if there's only six people in that class, then that's a success. And I also know that I have, but my president to me is very explicit that if we're fundraising for someone and we're inviting big name X into the room, then you better believe that that room better be filled when I invite that person in. So I think I just would put it that way.
You know, it's a really, really interesting question. I guess I have some ideas about what I think success might look like in terms of how to measure it and are we measuring it effectively. That is something that I think about too. Should we be passing out evaluations after adult ed programs? What kinds of questions should we be asking on those evaluations? But I guess in terms of sort of what does a success look like, which is an easier question for me, there are a couple things that I think about. The first is, in addition to the question of numbers and are numbers important, there's also the question of, are these the regular suspects or are there new people that are being brought in? So one of the things that felt really successful to me in this end-of-life panel that I just mentioned that we did a few weeks ago in Wilmette is it was really different faces than the faces that generally come to Bible Baboker or Wednesday morning Bible study or Thursday night theology class. It was members of the medical community. It was some of our older adults who are thinking about end-of-life issues, with some of our older, younger adults who have parents who are thinking about end-of-life issues. So to me, that felt successful because it was sort of opening up who comes into our building and what they come for. The second thing I would say is sort of building along that is there are certain programs that I've devised sort of with the particular goal of bringing people to the next level. So one example of that, and again, I'm new in my community this year, I created something this year called BHCB, which is the acronym of my synagogue, but it stands for Beth Hillel Coffee Break Extended. And it meets on Sunday mornings when religious school meets, and it's a walk to a local Starbucks and a schmooze and a walk back. Now, in terms of sort of content goals, really my goals were very, very minimal. I wanted in my first year as a new rabbi to get to know these young parents. for them to get to know each other. And my goal for next year is to take that same time slot and to create something a little more content rich, right? Whether it's still walking into Starbucks, which it very well may be, or whether it's not, but rather than just a schmooze, to actually bring in a little bit of learning. So to me, there's also a piece about sort of where do you want to go from this program and how do you want to connect people to the next program? So that's sort of the second thing I would think about. And then the third thing, if anything, I think about in terms of your question is, and Menachem talked a little bit about this at the beginning, that for me, it's not just about people learning something and leaving even with something of meaning, but it's feeling sort of changed by the experience in some way, whether that's changed in terms of the relationships they develop or changed in terms of the relationship to Jewish practice. But just knowing something in the context of a synagogue, for me, is not quite enough. I want them to be able to do something with that knowledge. So that's another thing I would think about.
The only thing that I would add, a lot of what Annie and Elliot have shared certainly resonates for me, is that there's a difference between a successful program and feeling successful as an educator. And that a lot of the times it's conflated because the attendance can certainly affect our spirit as a channel or a convener for Torah. And I think it's really important. I remember there was this one time that I was really pumped to teach Nefesh HaChaim, one of my favorite Sfarim, and I had prepared a lot, had a lot of copies, and three people came. And maybe it was bad timing, maybe it was good timing, maybe it was me, maybe it was the topic, maybe it was whatever. And, you know, part of me, and this is, it's not a nice part of me per se, was like, this is just not worth my time. And then I sort of, thank God, had that feeling before I walked into the room, and said to myself, did I read the book that I want to teach? Which tells me that the human spirit has infinite potential, and here I am with three worlds, ignoring that I'm one too, and how dare I feel that? So it's not that I was happy that three people, I should include myself, that four people were there, but I think that we owe it to Torah, let alone to our own commitment to Torah, let alone to the people who look to us, A, to see numbers as almost irrelevant, and the mission of sharing it being the point, which is one of the reasons that the online sharing, which is unquantifiable no matter the metrics, it's not a visceral experience, except that getting it out can feel viscerally satisfying. Like it's channeling something that you don't know where it'll touch. So I think feeling successful as a vehicle for Torah is much more important than anything else that we can measure. I still think it's important sometimes when it comes to budget and a sense of pride with community to know that it resonates and it's magnetic. But we should feel successful. And it's hard to say what makes you feel successful with Torah. And the only other thing that I'll say about it is that I know that for myself as a rabbi and for my community as it intentionally exists, it is important that no one, including me, no one should see me as the source of Torah. We are a deeply participatory community, and what that means is everyone should feel empowered to be a teacher of Torah. And that is a challenge. I don't get to let it out nearly as much as I want to, and that's actually a really good lesson in humility for me. So I think that when we see ourselves as the source for the stuff, that's also a problem. So success is, I feel so proud that I get to be part of the Torah, and I'm only a part of it is the other measure of success.
I'd like to ask a question about timing. In terms of weekly classes, in terms of bi-weekly classes, in terms of monthly classes, is there an optimal amount of time? I find that people today especially don't like to come to open-ended things. They just go until it stops. They like to have, or until the season's over or whatever, they like to have things in sizes that they can work with. So what kind of sizes do you recommend?
I'd say depends. But the way that I think it works well with my style of teaching is an hour and a half maximum for the entire time commitment, the first 5 minutes of which is usually hanging out and people show up late. After that, we sort of have a kavanah, bracha, that we always share, and making sure that I don't talk nonstop, which for me is kind of hard. And then by the end of it, racing for the end, because my favorite teacher of all time is Aviva Zornberg, and she sort of brings you into her method. And then the last 15 minutes, at least in my experience, I'm weeping the entire time. There's something about the way she accelerates, she pounds the soul, based on every idea that she's touched. So no matter how long it goes and when I start, I know that I want the last 15 minutes to be the only thing, you know, that I put all of the effort into. Everything gets me to those 15 minutes. So the timing is less important, but if it goes more than an hour and a half, even I'm going to sort of lose focus.
Yeah, I would say something similar. I mean, I think it very much depends. I think generally an hour to an hour and a half, depending on the venue and the class and the topic and all kinds of things. I think what in my mind is more important than exactly the amount of time is leaving enough time for all those important pieces. Something I do like to leave time for is at the beginning going around and having people do introductions, no matter how brief, in terms of creating sort of that sense of community. If you've got a lot of people to a class, even if you encourage people to go quickly, that can be a nice 10 or 15 minute chunk. So, you know, in scheduling out the time period for a class to keep things like that in mind. And I think it's also really important to end on time, right? If people have blocked off an hour and a half for the program, then to really do your very best to bring it on time. But I think it's a hard question to ask sort of in a vacuum about blocks of time.
How many classes in a section, though?
In a series. And that, again, for me, it sort of depends. Our rabbis at my synagogue generally teach in 3 to 4 week sessions once or twice during the year. You know, so that's one model. Something like my Bible Beboker is every single week continuously. I also teach a Wednesday morning Bible class mostly for older adults who are home during the day, and that's once a week for an hour. So I think it was sort of getting back to what Elliot was saying also, to have a variety of different classes, both different in terms of topic, different in terms of different times of the day, different in terms of different lengths of commitment, I think meet different scheduling needs and can be a nice way of structuring a program.
I'm going to just jump here and say, in my personal experience, daytime and evening also makes a difference, I think, in how to answer that question. It's much easier to have a Tuesday morning class that starts, you know, after Simchat Torah and goes, you know, till June. What I have found is with evening classes, that's much harder now. I used to be able to do that. I never do that anymore. Now if I'm teaching an evening class, it's going to be a 6 week on whatever it is, and then, you know, maybe I'll take a couple week break and then start up again. Because especially in the evening, and especially for those of us that live in colder climates and winter hits and it's dark and it's snowy and snowbirds and school and homework and God knows what else, I don't love being in a situation where I start teaching a class. It's one thing to walk in and have 3 people from the beginning. For me personally, it's a different thing if you start out with 20 and by, you know, the end of November you're down to 3. That's a little too demoralizing for me personally. So I think evenings work better for me personally. My congregation in classes that have a beginning and an end, and everybody knows what it is when they sign up.
I agree. I never thought of it that way, but that's exactly how it works out. Our evening classes are, you know, set limit number of classes. I think it's, and our morning classes operate on, I call it no guilt rules. So Friday morning, once a month, I have a class, Caffeine for the Soul. And it's really whatever I want to teach on, but it's Parsha or something going on in the news or the holiday that's coming up. I have one of those Starbucks coffee things there because the coffee in our shul sucks, and that's sort of the gimmick to get people there. It's always the no guilt rule is whether you were there last month or plan to be there. If it works for you that day, it's great to have you. So that works. The evening classes are different, and I actually each one of the clergy teach a post-minion class. Mine is essential essays. So if you think about those essays, you know, Rabidovich, Moshe Greenberg on biblical, you know, just think about those like classic essays. Now, some of them are not so essential. I've been teaching it for the last, you know, however many years. But or we'll take a book chapter by chapter, but I PDF, you know, the chapter out, the article out. It's just always long enough for people to fall asleep to the night before. And then it helps bolster minion that morning. And then we have people there. My oath to them is that we are done by 9 a.m., so they can get to work. So I do have a lot of professionals come to that. And if they miss a week, so I might have 75 people who, or maybe 100 people who receive the email every week with the essay. I have them out on Shabbos so people can have them in the if they want them. And then it's maybe about 25 people on any given morning might actually show up, and they're different, and there's no guilt, and they're discrete units. So I think you have to acknowledge both muscle groups.
I'm curious if you have thoughts. I'm Eric Woodward, Columbus, Ohio. Thoughts on an introduction to Judaism class. So we have one, something I've noticed that goes on. It's a class that's sort of generally geared for people who are in a conversion process and are sort of going through that. And sometimes you have people who are partnered with somebody who's Jewish, and sometimes the Jewish partner attends. And a thing that I've discovered is often the Torah in that class is really fantastic. I mean, you have, you know, 40 sessions over the course of the year, and you have, you know, you say, oh, we have 3 sessions on Pesach and 2 on Shavuot. You teach really great things. And I'm trying to wonder, is there a way that you guys, that y'all have thought of a way to have classes, like some sort of intro to Judaism class that's open up in a more broad way, or a way to sort of take some of the sort of teaching that's in that and bring it elsewhere. If anybody else relates to this, I mean, maybe it's, I don't know, I'm sort of curious for your thoughts in general introduction to Judaism.
I mean, the closest thing that I can think of like an introduction to Judaism class that isn't exactly an introduction to Judaism class is adult B'nai Mitzvah programs, which I imagine many of us have at our synagogues also. That can be another way, you know, for people who are a little bit beyond introduction to Judaism, but are looking sort of for, I think one of the things that's often nice about intro to Judaism classes is the sense of community that develops, and that becomes part of the class itself. I think that often also happens in adult B'nai Mitzvah programs. But I think adult B'nai Mitzvah programs can be places to sort of tackle basic Judaism in a way that doesn't feel too infantilizing to people, or that invites them in at a level that feels appropriate.
I'll just add, it's a complicated thing to do, but you know, the vignette that I shared with what turned into a podcast, what was really because of one of those classes, it was an intro to Judaism class that I happened to record because someone happened to not be there. I mean, the challenge of recording things and making videos of them or talking to them is you end up playing to the recorder, you play to the camera sometimes, and it really does change the environment. I'm doing an Ask the Rabbi spin-off from that original experience now, and it's very interesting because there was a request that it be on YouTube for people. So now it's on YouTube, but not everyone who comes to the conversation agrees to be recorded, and so the thing is like shoved in my face. And I'm like aware that you might have asked me the question, but I'm sort of looking over there because I can't help it. So I'm not saying that the way to take from what is so awesome about those kinds of classes and share it beyond is to instantly think, digitize it, put it out there, make sure it's out. But on the other hand, there's only so much of those experiences, and it's beautiful to share. If what I said was, take that segment and teach it at a different time, you just did it, and you'll be less excited, and there's no way to know that it'll work just as well in a different timing. So on the one hand, you can just make it open. But if you just make it open, who's to say anybody will come? That's like issuing an invitation to everyone to come do something. No one comes. But if you can take some of that and channel it, maybe even record the audio of it and maybe ask someone, a teenager in your shul, to do some sound editing, to do some audio editing, so that the segments that are really worthwhile are captured somehow and shared. It might help. It might be a distraction from the very experience, in which case it's better to have it be limited. So sad for everybody else, but don't you wish you were learning Torah right here? So I think in a certain sense, it's kind of great to want more of it and to not have that ability yet.
I think, first of all, find resources that are out there, right? You don't need to be you're not the first person to teach an intro to Judaism class. So, if it's through the RA, if it's through the Petach Ohel efforts, right? I'm sure, you know, what community are you in?
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio, okay. So, and there are introductory Melton sorts of programs out there as well. I think something that I'd really like to explore into the years ahead, which are on the intro to Judaism, just to shift the focus for a second, and if anyone's doing anything like this, I'd love to hear, are adult education efforts that empower home ritual and people to, you know, whether it's Hadlakat Nerot, saying Kiddush, leading a Seder, you know, all the things that we want our Jews to do, right? There is a sort of disconnect that you might be teaching a class on Rosenzweig, but someone's unable, you know, to say Kiddush at their table or whatever it might be. And, right, what would that actually look like if synagogues took on the responsibility of, you know, creating the through technology, through recordings, through, you know, whatever it might be, to create a communal culture where we are the vehicles towards empowering you in your own home ritual? Because I think people are afraid to go up to their rabbi and say, well, you know what, I don't really know how to say Kiddush. I don't really know, right? So what would it look like if you did that in a non-guilt, non-shaming way? But this is how, and we've done a little bit at Park Avenue with this, but I think that's a really, really important place for us as colleagues, given what we all know is not happening in the homes of our congregants. And actually, I think it's something we could all work together on. We're having a preliminary dialogue with Fred something or other, who's created a whole curriculum about having Shabbat.
Fred Clark,
about creating, having Shabbat table conversations at your home. Okay, so now why you and other organizations do this, but, you know, you have the thing from the clip of the Parsha, five leading questions for your Shabbos table. And so it's one document, but it's coming from different rabbis. You know, so it comes from, you know, Rabbi X's email box. I think things like that are really, really important for us to get into the business of. And they should be shared amongst all of us.
Hi, Barbara Speyer, Los Angeles. I'm just curious, given, aside from the holidays and Parshat HaShavua and all of that, how you decide which courses you're going to offer in adult education. Do you look at the demographics of your congregation? And my other part of that is, I work at the VA and I work with a lot of elderly people. I often hear people say that the synagogues don't offer caregiver support groups and things like that. Not that that's adult education, but it is something else that I'm wondering, you know, what plays into, you know, if it's taught Shabbat, that's for kids, but what happens to the rest of the congregation?
Yeah, I think when we bifurcate our programming into chesed versus learning, we're doing a disservice to everything, to God, to people, to community. And so I think it's a really important question, especially in the way that you asked it. So trying to answer parts of your question in a holistic way, you know, I really am only good at teaching things that I'm excited about, and I'm not excited about everything. The things I care about, I really care about, but that's not everything. And so I think I just choose arbitrarily, which isn't necessarily systemic. Systemically, at least in my shul right now, we're trying to do some decent work to rebuild our Bikur Cholim group. And so maybe thinking forward about the efforts in the year to come, working on what it is to provide chesed, what's the definition of chesed, and then seeing myself, all right, so if what I really want to teach didn't sound like that before, maybe the frame for the thing I want to teach, so if it's Rosenzweig, just using that, the notion that the command is relational, right? So I could focus on the philosophy of Rosenzweig as it applies to, but the truth is a lot of it is scattered. One of the ways of approaching an educational experience for a community is to have a theme. But one of the ways is not. I mean, we've prioritized steady learning, not thematic learning. So it is important to all of us. I would say to me, and it is, but I'm only one part of the whole, the committee discerns, you know, what are the topics that people want for their special things. We have not prioritized visiting scholars, though we've been lucky that sometimes visiting scholars are available. So it's important that after Kiddush, a member is teaching members, and after Kiddush learning based on their passions. Sunday morning, there's a speaker series. Monday morning, there is a Parsha study. Wednesday afternoon, Parsha study. Wednesday evening, for conversion. Thursday afternoon, for Talmud. Those are much more important than the other things that we do, and the topics are already decided, and the subjective presentation, like who's doing the presenting, determines the content sometimes. So I sort of think the free flow of Torah is more important than advanced planning, but that presumes a dislocation of the learning from what we are as a community. And so I take your question as a really serious challenge.
I'm not sure I have so much more to add. I would say that I also, a lot of the things I choose to teach are things that that come from a desire to teach them. I also do sometimes get suggestions from members of my congregation, and that's always fun if it feels like something that I think I can do well. In terms of the second part of your question, I think that a moment of learning for me over the last few weeks is that I've often thought of, in terms of different, especially age demographics and how to meet those demographics in the context of adult education, up until recently, I thought about that more in terms of the kinds of offerings time-wise and less about the kinds of offerings content-wise. So, you know, offering things during the day for seniors who can't drive so easily at night, or actually in terms of my women's trips, one of the key demographics we were trying to hit with those women's trips were sort of empty nesters and people who have a little more discretionary income and not young kids at home and are underserved. So that until recently, that's more how I thought about that question. An interesting byproduct of this end-of-life panel that I did is that a lot of older adults and younger adults caring for older adults sort of approached me saying that they would like to see more of this kind of programming, whether it's about writing living wills and things like that, or sort of the legal aspect of advanced directives and bringing in someone who is more expert in that. And it did make me think that just as there are certain content needs for young families, there are also certain content needs for older adults, and I think that is a really interesting sort of way of thinking about that issue.
So aside from our lunch and learns at midday, we were partners with Dorot, that we had a call-in class, sort of. So we had a Toranut amongst us that we could call, and one of us would teach, and people could call in to a number, and not just our congregants, but it didn't make a difference. It was the same class. But it was a nice way for homebound congregants to do learning who weren't Skype ready. That's it. And I think it's the same thing. Like it's, though I would put a little sharper edge on it, it's always nice to ask congregants what they want. But right, what's the expression? Ein adam lomed ela b'makom shelibo chafetz. Right. So I don't melamed other than where I'm passionate about teaching. And I, you know, woe unto the rabbi who doesn't think about what their constituency wants. But at the same time, if I'm passionate about Kaplan or about the ethics of memory or about, you know, gosh darn it, it's been 50 years since Waxman's tradition and change, my congregants hear that passion and feel that passion. So that usually, not all the time, but usually wins the day in choosing classes.
So I want to add just one thing to the discussion, because I was thinking about, for me, and for all of us, I'm sure, well, maybe not for all of us, for those of us that are in the congregational rabbinate, the most consistent week in, week out, for 24 years I've been in my congregation, is Shabbat morning, which for me is, I would say the biggest moments of the year. And I inherited what I do, so I wouldn't even know how to tell people how to do it, and I'm wondering, I'm sure I'm not the only one doing it, but I never give a sermon on Shabbat, never. I teach Torah. First of all, it's fantastic because I never have to think about, you know, how can I connect the New York Times to the Parsha. So that's never a concern. I don't have to waste my time thinking about it. And I've really been amazed over the years that, you know, you can take a couple of verses with a little bit of interesting commentary. I don't really spend that much time even, I know, I should forget, I'm not going to say that. never mind, just scratch that. And I teach Torah. And then I ask people what they think about, you know, this commentary verse. I like finding things that, like, you know, where they argue with each other, right? So what do you think about what this one says versus what this one says? So some of the people in the room, we've been doing this together for 24 years. And the depth of the conversation with people that you've been studying with for that long is pretty incredible. Very often they ask me a question I don't know the answer to. And it's an act of great humility to say, I have to get back to you on that one. I really don't know. But I also insisted, this is something that I changed, that my predecessor did not do, is that I do it whether we have a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah or not. Because I really believe that there is something, that Torah has something to say for every single person that's sitting in that room. And and they can participate. And I always have a bar or bat mitzvah guest raise their hand, ask a question, have something they want to say, find me at Kiddush and say, you know, I wasn't comfortable saying this, but, you know, I want to ask you about this down here. I've never heard anybody talk about, you know, talk about the Torah before. Like, it's not really that hard to find somebody that's going to talk about Torah, but maybe you've never been in the right place. But for me, I will also say my proudest moment is when one of the kids in the room raises their hand and asks a question, because they feel like then you're modeling that it's, you know, we've been focusing obviously today on adult education, but what we all passionately believe is it doesn't matter how old you are and what stage of life you're in, and that a room full of people who are in very different age groups, stages, home at the congregation, guests at the congregation, all can have access into this text that we love. And so I'd love to hear if other people, you know, do something different on Shabbat morning than just, you know, than just a sermon. But for me, it's been the most gratifying part of my rabbinate.
Deborah, picking up on that, I appreciated hearing all these different suggestions for taking into account the needs of the different generations. And one thing I love most about congregational work is that it is a multi-generational environment. And I'm wondering if you have other examples from among the four of you of things that have worked really well as far as multi-generational learning opportunities.
So one of the most successful programs of the last few years, Deborah, has been a teen parent study group at my home. There's something magical about opening up your home to a congregant, something also, you know, grating about it, but there's something magical about it. And so once a month, we have the price of admission, as it were, is a teenager and one or both parents. And the conversations are amazing. And so that's one thing off the top of my head. Next year I'm going to do something with the congregational school students, and we have survivors in our community, and so we're going to do something on memory with that.
I think another nice opportunity to create a multi-generational moment of Torah study and also sort of model teaching Torah in the home, as Elliot was talking about, is when I meet with B'nai Mitzvah families, one of the things I help them to do as the rabbi is I help students write their Divrei Torah. And so in working with the families, I have them as a family at home read the parsha together, and we sort of talk about what that means to read a parsha as a family and what are some of the questions they might talk about. And then they come in and the family and I study the parsha a little bit together. And I think it's both helping kids and their parents study Torah together, but it's also, in a way, giving parents the skills to do this, not only at this moment of becoming a bat mitzvah, but also at other times. I found that to be sort of a successful piece.
My name's Adina Weber. My husband's Reuven Barkin, and I think he'll give me permission to speak on his behalf. And we're from Savannah, Georgia, or now living in Savannah, Georgia. There are a lot of programs that he's actually created, a lot of teaching opportunities that he has created. It started, I think maybe we were there for 3 weeks, and people would come up to him and say, I would like to convert to Judaism. And so the first thing that he actually created was a conversion class. And I'm telling you, I don't think we've been there for a month yet. That happened. And some of the people who are part of that program have actually thus have since converted and still take part in this weekly class. And that, I think, has created a community. Another thing that he does is on Wednesday mornings, there's a late service. They dive in at 8, and then there's a breakfast and learning, and they talk, I think, about God and how God plays a role in all that. Thursday morning after Minyan, a small group meets and learns Midrash together with him after Minyan. Saturday after lunch, he does Parsha HaShavua. And then he created a Chavura-based kind of system where a maximum of 10 people can be part of a study group. He will say to them, what do you want to study? And so each group is different. He now has 5 different groups, one that meets every week, and I think the 4 others that meet once a month, and they continue to grow in terms of creating more groups. And then on Shabbos morning, the last thing that he's actually created is that between Shacharis and the Torah service, he stops the service, and he teaches a little bit about prayer and working on the Amidah right now. And he does this for about 15 minutes every Shabbos morning, and he finds that's actually the greatest Torah that he teaches during the Shabbat service. Because people are engaged and they're taking part in that. But personally, it's amazing to hear other programs, and being in a small town, you know, we have less resources, but we have created things also.
All right, I want to thank everyone for participating. I don't know, Jonathan, do you have a like final word to say to the group?
I want to thank all of you. I also want to just add another resource, Ayeka, Arye Ben David, who has a wonderful program. I'm curious if anybody participated in his teaching, where he teaches people how to teach in a soulful, engaging way. So it's just a resource you can jot down and look it up on the internet. But thank you to our wonderful, illustrious panel, and for all the great Torah coming out of this room, and from our movement, and from our colleagues. The next session is going to be in this room in 15 minutes, and there's another session next door in 15 minutes. So with our model,